Good day. Listening public, today is January 9th, 2020. This is the currently, but perhaps not always, untitled SAN podcast. We'll get to that in a moment. I am Dan Silverman, joined, as always, by my co-host, Cheryl Dapp. Cheryl, are you there?
Hi, everybody.
Great. And today, our special guest is Kimberly Foer of West Virginia University. Kimberly, do you read us?
I do. Thank you.
Okay, great. So we are excited today because, as I mentioned, we have currently been untitled in this podcast for its first four or five episodes, wherever we are. And so I have come up with a few possible titles. I wanted to have Cheryl and Kimberly be our two-person, totally unprepared focus group, and I can also just send these back to the drawing board. So here are some possible ones. Hold your applause in all comments until the end. So definitely, maybe, dependable, audio presence, general disclosure, state audioization. Do any of those seem remotely reasonable?
Okay, I like general disclosure.
Okay.
I agree. I like that as well. Definitely, maybe.
Yeah, it's a little too much of an Oasis reference, I think, is part of the problem.
But I think it might be a little bit accurate for who we are and what we do.
Yeah, it is. Okay, so that's one that you might, that it also seems reasonable. I went with, the dependable is kind of a play on it depends, which is what we, you know, say everything and is always our discount code. But it also could be like a little too generic and arrogant. So, you know, we can strike that.
Well, I appreciate having the options. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll think about these. I appreciate the feedback and we may or may not end up using these. So Kimberly, we decided to ask you to be a guest after your sparkling performance at the WCET annual meeting, and we're going to talk a little bit about a few different things, about how things are going at West Virginia, some of the aspects of professional development that you use, and how you kind of put things like the WCET annual meeting into that program for yourself. But before we do, we're going to start as we usually do, which is, however you define your career, why do you do this? You're a person with lots of talents and interests. Why do this?
That's a really good question. my background is in higher education. I am originally from Alaska, and so I started teaching. I taught public speaking for many years at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And from there, I moved on to a college in upstate New York, where I taught student leadership for engineers. And I spent 5 years there, and I ultimately landed in West Virginia because I thought it was a pretty state. I wish I had a better reason, but WVU absolutely took a chance on me 10 years ago. I've been here 10 years now. And I started as a regional recruiter. So I worked for undergraduate admissions and for WVU online. So I worked with traditional students as well as adult learners. And I did that role remotely. So I have actually lived and worked 2.5 hours from campus for the last 10 years. About 2 years ago, our department went under a leadership change. And our new dean came from a school that had a designated staff member that did state authorization work. And he recognized quickly that we didn't have that. And so he called me one day and asked me if I would be interested. And I have to say, I wasn't sure because I wasn't familiar. And I knew it would be starting a new career, essentially. And he actually said, there's a great network of people that I know. And he was referring to the state authorization network. He said, we will get you in there and you'll be fine. So I absolutely said yes. I was excited to be able to continue working remotely and also to do something new and something different from anything I had ever done before. Turns out I love it. And I know for anyone who is new in this field listening to this, they might wonder how that came to be. I know that, you know, at the beginning I was overwhelmed and it was just so much information to take in and to learn. But I've really grown to, I really enjoy the job, and I enjoy being able to make sure that students who are interested in WVU know that they can get a quality education that can then carry them after graduation.
If higher ed were to be outlawed, what would you do?
Oh. Wow. I have to say I would probably go into the nonprofit field. Just because I have spent, I spent 20 years as a victims advocate, and I did that on a volunteer basis, and I'm now the treasurer of our local Rotary group, so I do a lot of work with them in the schools here. So I think that I would go into nonprofit. Tough question, Dan.
Well, that's one of my specialties. Well, Cheryl just joined the Optimists, so you guys could chat about the civic group life. Now, as you have been learning about this area, what is your general approach to professional development, and how do conferences such as WCET annual meeting, but others too, how do they fit, or how do they not fit, or how does it work for you?
They absolutely fit. And I think my entire career, and I think most people in higher ed will tell you this, that it's always about gaining knowledge from where you can find it. Whether that be, a professional conference somewhere else, whether it be just the daily emails that come through from newsletters, reading articles in the Chronicle. I think all of those play into every part of higher ed. I'm very lucky to have a great supervisor and a great dean who are very generous in allowing me to go to all of the events that I can. I know for a lot of schools, budgeting becomes an issue. And sometimes conferences and the travel and all of the expenses can really add up. So I've been very fortunate every time I say, hey, WCET or SAN is having this conference, I really need to attend this because it's going to be beneficial. That I'm given the green light. But even if I wasn't, I think there are enough resources out there that you can absolutely continue to learn, and you can gather your own level of professional development, without the expense. But I mean, I tell everybody who has ever asked me anything about state authorization to please go to the basics workshop wherever it may be. That was the first thing that I did. It was in Colorado. It was 2 years ago. It was in the fall, and it was in Colorado. And ever since that, I've been threatening to move to Colorado because it was so beautiful. And that workshop really kind of cemented not only the information that I had to learn, but it set a really good foundation and provided me with so many materials to work from that I don't know that I would have survived this long without that. So I absolutely tell people, even if I just met some people in St. Louis, actually at the Advanced Topics Workshop, who had yet to attend the basics. And, they asked me, what can I do? What should I do? I'm like, please go to the basics workshop. If I could go back, I actually don't know if I can. I probably could. But if I could go back, I would absolutely attend that all the time, because I just think that that was fundamental in me learning what I know now about state authorization.
Well, there's a story probably apocryphal about Vince Lombardi, which is that he would start every training camp with the Packers by saying, "This is a football." You know, there's some benefit to going back to the basics for everyone. But thank you for those kind words about our programs. This was not intended to be an infomercial.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, we didn't pay her to do that.
No, we didn't. but one more question on that, and then we'll switch over to West Virginia, what's going on there, is when you come back from whether it's the SAN workshop or other things that you attend, what, if anything, do you do to share what you've learned with others?
Well, I have to say, so I'm the only person at WVU who does this line of work. I always try, when I come back, I usually type up a summary or synopsis. I share that with my supervisor and with our dean, because he's very interested, and he stays up to date on what I'm doing. And he's very supportive. So I always make sure that I share with them. But then every time I've been to a workshop or a conference, you know, we always sit at tables, and I always feel like I'm at a table with new people. And so we try to, you know, we collect cards and we network, which is probably one of the most beneficial things of the workshops and the conferences. And then we start an email group list. And the last advanced topics workshop in St. Louis has really produced probably the best, you know, work group, for lack of a better term, work group that I've experienced, because there were new people to the job. There were, you know, people like me who've been here for 2 years, which really isn't a long time, but kind of feels like forever sometimes. and so we're able to share information, and we're really emailing each other at least a couple times a week. So I think the networking that I get when I return from any of them is one of the best things that can happen out of a workshop or a conference. I am, and we may get into this next, but you know, when I went to the annual meeting, was really when, you know, we started focusing on the new federal regulations. And so when I came back, I scheduled time to meet with our legal department, who I'm actually meeting with next week, to discuss that. So, you know, I think you get something out of every event or meeting or workshop or conference that you attend. And then when you come back, it's just trying to organize that to help you in what you need to do with it. But I would say that definitely the networking is the top takeaway, that I get from anything that I attend.
That's great news about those groups that you form informally. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we're hoping for. And I hadn't ever heard anyone tell it to me that way, at least that clearly. So we really appreciate that. And maybe we'll talk to you another time about how that works. Cheryl, did you have any other questions before we move on or about what's going on at WVU?
No, but I just really appreciate the way you did articulate that, Kimberly, because, you know, the whole basis for our network is to make sure the interactions are occurring. And so, you know, not only are we sharing information, but we're also helping you all interact so that you can have more depth to what it is that you do. So I'm glad it's working. So thanks for sharing that.
It's definitely working. And I was just talking to someone about this the other day, that I have met a couple of people at these state authorization conferences and workshops that are actually, they're in the legal field, they're attorneys and they're lawyers, and they're new to state authorization. And so I always tell them, I'm like, oh, you have such a benefit because you know how to read these regulations. And so, but then they come back and they're like, but, you know, but there are other things that I don't understand. And so we're kind of able to tap into each other's knowledge in a way that is helpful for all of us. And I think something, another thing that we've talked about is how important it is to ask the questions, you know, because even if, you know, since I've been doing this for 2 years, even if I've heard that question 20 times, you know, someone who just started the job last month has never heard that or has never asked it or seen the answer. So it's, I think it's important that we have all of these different levels that come together, because then we're really able to connect in a different way.
So you mentioned the implementation of the federal regulations. How is that going so far? What is something that's gone well, and what's a challenge maybe?
I wish I could tell you that it's great and we're done, but I can't. I'm at a position where what I have really been working on, and this is kind of how I've approached this job from the get-go, is I like to have a very strategic plan. And I like to know who I need to talk to at what level and who is going to best support me to get the information into the proper hands for the different departments at our university. And, you know, the federal regulations are, they're huge. And so we, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, but I feel like I have built relationships that will help us get there, and will help the implementation be smooth. You know, I'm absolutely getting, I'm meeting with legal next week, and I have a document to hand to them. And that is just the information that I have gathered on, you know, here's exactly what we have to do to be in compliance. And, my dean has now had very good conversations with the provost office, and they have deans and directors meetings. So the next step will be to meet with them and to say, here's what this is, here's why we have to do this, here is how it affects the programs in your departments, and here are the tools that you need to implement this. So, I think that this works really well.
So what have you done specifically to cultivate that relationship? Because I think of someone in that, at that dean level, to really deliver that message. Is there anything you've done specifically for that, or has this particular dean kind of already had an interest or understood the importance of this?
Well, and that's a pretty broad question, because it depends on the dean. I have to say my relationship with state authorization, specifically with professional licensure, has been with those people in, you know, in the nursing department, in the education department, in our, you know, in our physical therapy department. My relationship is with the people who are placing the students in clinical placement sites. I was actually very lucky to get those, because they kind of came from word of mouth. I had someone in physical therapy who was like, hey, you know, we used to look at this Sarah map, but now it's gone. And I have to say that that was a very strategic move on my part to remove that map from our website, because that really prompted people to then call me. And that then I was able to open up the discussion of, here's what we can and can't do, and here's what we need to be aware of. I find that a lot of times it's not that people are doing anything to be malicious, it's because they just don't know. And so I've really tried to educate the different departments. But I've really started to, I myself build the relationships with the people who have direct contact with the students. My dean, the dean of WVU Online, Keith Bailey, he does a great job at cultivating those relationships with the other deans, and really getting state authorization and professional licensure on their radars. And then that then prompts the departments to help build relationships with me. I hope that made sense.
It did. It sounds like you've figured out the org chart where things need to happen. And that can be a huge challenge for people. And the fact that you're able to do it working remotely, you know, not just running into people at the squash courts, so to speak, is pretty impressive, I think.
People on campus are probably glad that I work remotely sometimes.
Sure. Cheryl, did you have any follow-up from that?
No, I just really do appreciate, you know, how you are able to interact with people. Because, you know, as you all are aware, Dan and I work remotely with our organization, which is fine because we reach across the country. But you have a physical campus and you have people there and you're able to attract the needed attention to the topic areas that you wish them to review. So good work.
And I also think that it's worth mentioning too that we do stress a lot in our workshops and our content about getting the key stakeholders on board, and that is incredibly important. But also the emphasis on the people who are, in this case, with placing the students and the licensure people. Those people are in each department. Yeah, and they do tend to be a little lower on the chart, but they're the ones who can ultimately implement this stuff. And so as well, so that's, or ultimately have to. So that's a great reminder for everyone to focus on those.
I think too, somebody, and it may have been Cheryl who said this, I don't remember who it was, but somebody once said at its very basic level that state authorization is consumer protection for students. And that always stuck with me. And so, you know, coming from a teaching background as well, I'm very student focused. And so when I started this, my priority was, okay, I have to find out, you know, where these students are, where they're coming from. Are they going to be able to do their jobs in that state with the education that we're providing them? How do I get to the students? You know, how do I help the students? And so for me, the natural place to do that was with the faculty or the clinical placement coordinators who were speaking directly with the students and who were getting those student inquiry questions from the get-go.
Makes sense to me. We're going to switch over now to our regulation of the month, unless Carol, you have anything to add to that?
I'm looking forward to hearing what our regulation of the month is.
Oh, our regulation of the month. Well, and this is not, we end up not getting to one every month, but we're going to do it, Cheryl, even if it means we have a few, we're going to cut into your musicals a little bit, I think. This is fortuitous with Kimberly's work, I guess, as a victim's advocate. Again, not planned, but I was looking through the Michigan. The reason we do this is because sometimes this regulatory work, and particularly looking at professional board regulations, can be so abstract. And so we do find it useful occasionally to just pull out some specific ones and highlight those. So in Michigan, State Board of Social Work requires training standards for identifying victims of human trafficking. And so that would be the kind of regulation that you'd have to be following if your students are hoping to be licensed in Michigan. That's R338.2929 in the Michigan code, should you want to look it up, which you probably might. So Cheryl, let's switch over to musicals here.
This always makes me worried, but go ahead.
No, this is the best part of the show. I mean, everybody knows that. So this first question came to me after thinking back to Russ's report from visiting the Telluride Film Festival, and then with Megan, our colleague Megan Raymond, talking about how she was too jumpy to sit through even an entire movie, just one. Whereas when Russ goes to the Telluride Film Festival, he sees, you know, two, three a day for a few days. And Is there a limit for you, Cheryl, on how much you can see?
No, I think this is a really interesting topic area because there is discussion right now about what is too long for a Broadway musical, because Les Mis is about a 3-hour musical, and recently they cut back the revival of West Side Story to be a 90-minute without an intermission. And, you know, there are some of us that are traditionalists that are kind of up in arms about that because they've taken out some pretty key aspects of the musical in order to do this. But I personally, if I'm engaged with what's happening on stage, then I can sit through, you know, a longer period of time. But what I'm understanding is that there is some sort of feeling out there that a shorter period would be more better taken by some of the people. But I'm telling you, if I've paid what I pay for a stage show, I'll sit there for hours because I've paid to be there and I'm paying to be entertained. So I don't have a limit of good work.
Right. Of course. Yeah. What about the,
but I will tell you that 1 hour of the Pokemon movie, when it came out about 15 years ago and my kids wanted to see it, 1 hour was too long of the Pokemon movie. Just saying that.
Did you make it through the whole thing?
I made it through the whole thing, but it was the most miserable movie I've ever seen.
Yes. Certain acts of endurance that you have to go through.
Things you do for your kids.
Right. Now, you mentioned Les Mis and some revivals. What's your take on the revivals versus why can't we come up with new stuff? Endless debate.
Well, there are some classics that are worth bringing back. That's for sure. I think one of the things that's happening right now too is they're looking to old television and movies and creating musicals out of those. And I'm not quite sure if all of those were really meant to be. I don't know. You know, I really wasn't looking forward to, and it's done fairly well, but Beetlejuice, I didn't care for the movie. So putting music to it, I didn't know if that would be the missing ingredient, you know, to make it successful. But there are certain classics that really are, it does benefit us to bring them back for a new generation to be able to appreciate the quality of that kind of a production.
And lastly, how do you, as 2020 is upon us, obviously a totally arbitrary new year, but anyway, how do you track? How do you see all what's coming, either to Broadway or to Dayton or to wherever? How do you keep track of the news?
Hi, can you all hear me? I was having some difficulty with the tech here. Can you hear me now?
Yep, gotcha. Yep.
Okay. There are plenty of publications out there, just like there are for higher ed. There are plenty of publications that will share Broadway World, Playbill, that have social network presence. So there's certainly plenty of places to learn about what's coming, what's there now. So I don't have any difficulty finding out.
Well, that's all we have for Cheryl on musical.
Thanks, Dan.
For the entire podcast. Thank you, Kimberly. Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you to anybody who's listening. And we will be back next month.
Thanks, Kimberly, for being on with us. And thanks, Dan, for hosting. Take care, everyone.